Torts, 15th Edition, Chapter 1, An Introduction to the Common Law of Torts. Narration script for audio conversion. This script is written as continuous spoken narration rather than as an outline. It is organized in two parts. Part 1 narrates the non-case material in the chapter, the explanatory text, notes, and background sections. Part 2 narrates the three cases in the chapter, each presented first as a short spoken summary of the case, and then as an issue, rule, application, and conclusion, spoken in flowing sentences rather than as labeled bullet points. Part 1. Narration of the non-case material. Section 1. An overview of tort law. Let's begin with the most basic question. What is tort law? Tort law is the body of law that governs civil liability for harm that one person causes another, outside of any contract between them. That harm might be to a person's body, their property, their emotions, their reputation, their privacy, or their financial interests. The word tort comes from the Latin word tortus, meaning twisted, and from the French word tort, meaning wrong or injury. That origin tells you something important. A tort usually involves some kind of wrongdoing by the defendant, whether that wrongdoing is intentional, reckless, or merely negligent. There are a few narrow exceptions, though. Some areas of tort law impose what's called strict liability, meaning the defendant can be held liable even if they didn't act wrongfully at all. Historically, tort law has been developed mostly through the common law, that is, through judges deciding individual cases and building up rules over time, rather than through legislatures writing statutes. That common law development is still the primary focus of most torts courses, but statutes do matter too. Legislatures define what counts as wrongdoing in some contexts. They set or eliminate duties of care. They impose time limits on when lawsuits can be filed. They change the available defenses. They determine how damages get divided among multiple defendants. And they create rights for a deceased person's estate or family to sue. In recent decades, especially because of what's called the tort reform movement, legislatures have played an increasingly large role in reshaping what used to be purely judge-made law. It's also worth noting that tort law used to be a pretty obscure academic subject, something only law students, professors, and practicing attorneys thought much about. That has changed. Today, ordinary people regularly encounter tort law in the news. Lawsuits over police misconduct, environmental harm, dangerous drugs and medical devices, defamation claims involving public figures, debates over insurance premiums, and worries about liability for firearms, blood products, and vaccines. And on a personal level, almost everyone has had some brush with tort law, even if it's just a minor car accident. As you study this subject, keep in mind what tort law is actually trying to accomplish. Five purposes are usually identified. First, to give people a peaceful way to resolve disputes about harm, so they don't take matters into their own hands. Second, to deter wrongful conduct. Third, to encourage socially responsible behavior. Fourth, to restore injured people to their original condition, as much as money can do that, by compensating them. And fifth, to vindicate individuals' rights to redress when they've been wronged. A central question runs through the whole subject. Should people always be compensated whenever they're injured by someone else's action? If your answer is yes, you'd favor a system of strict liability across the board, or perhaps a government-run compensation scheme like workers' compensation. But if you don't think every injured person should be compensated, then the harder question becomes, what rules should determine who gets compensated and under what circumstances? That is really the central problem tort law is trying to solve, and it's a problem that evolves over time as circumstances change, which is, after all, the great virtue of the common law. Section 2, Development of Liability Based on Fault. Background. Before we get to the three cases in this section, let's talk about where tort law came from historically. Historians disagree about exactly how the law of torts began. One theory, associated with Oliver Wendell Holmes, is that liability started out based on actual intent and personal moral fault, and only later moved toward more objective, community-based standards. Another, more widely accepted theory holds the opposite, that the law started with strict liability for anyone who caused physical harm, and only gradually evolved toward liability based on fault and community standards. A third theory says there's been no steady one-directional progression at all, that the balance between fault-based and no-fault periods has simply shifted back and forth as a matter of degree. To understand the cases that follow, it helps to know a bit about the old English forms of action. After the Norman conquest, a person could only bring a case in the king's courts if the king had issued a specific writ authorizing that type of claim. The nobility kept the number of available writs limited, which produced a rigid technical system of pleading. Two of these writs are the direct ancestors of modern tort law, the writ of trespass and the writ of trespass on the case, often just called case. Trespass covered direct, forcible injuries, force applied immediately from the defendant to the plaintiff. Case covered injuries that were indirect or consequential. The classic example is a log thrown into the road. If you're hit by the log as it's thrown, that's trespass. If you come along later and trip over the log after it's already come to rest, that's case. Note that this distinction was not about whether the defendant acted intentionally or negligently. It was about the causal sequence, direct versus indirect, not about the defendant's state of mind. Modern negligence law, along with actions for nuisance, conversion, deceit, defamation, malicious prosecution, and interference with economic relations, all grew out of the action on the case rather than out of trespass. Today, of course, we no longer use these old writs. Instead, a plaintiff must plead and prove the elements of a modern cause of action. For example, a modern negligence claim requires the plaintiff to establish five things: that the defendant owed a duty of care, that the defendant breached that duty, that the breach caused the plaintiff's harm, that the harm fell within the scope of the risk created by the defendant's conduct, what's traditionally called proximate cause, and that the plaintiff suffered a legally compensable injury. With that background in mind, let's turn to Section 3, on the modern landscape of tort law, and Section 4, on trial procedure, and we'll come back to the three cases from Section 2 afterward, in Part 2 of this narration. Section 3, the landscape of modern tort law. Modern tort law is generally organized into three broad categories, based on how culpable the defendant's conduct was. The first category is intentional torts, where liability depends on whether the defendant intended the wrong or the harm. The second is negligence and recklessness, where liability comes from conduct that was unreasonable but not deliberate, an accident caused by carelessness. The third is strict liability, where courts impose liability regardless of whether the defendant's conduct was wrongful at all. Negligence is by far the most commonly litigated tort, and much of any torts course is devoted to unpacking its elements. But tort law also includes products liability, assault, battery, false imprisonment, negligent and intentional infliction of emotional distress, defamation, nuisance, trespass to land, trespass to personal property, and fraud, among others. Every one of these causes of action has its own distinct elements, though all of them require the plaintiff to prove causation and what's called scope of liability, or proximate cause. New tort causes of action do occasionally emerge. In the 1960s, courts first began imposing strict liability for injuries caused by defective products. In the 1980s, claims for negligent infliction of emotional distress and so-called loss of chance claims gained real traction. But for the most part, this is a stable, well-settled area of law. In terms of what actually generates tort litigation, automobile accidents are by far the most common source of claims, followed at a distance by medical malpractice, then harm from dangerous conditions on land, and intentional torts like battery and assault. Other recurring fact patterns include property damage and theft, defective products, defamation, professional malpractice by lawyers or accountants, animal attacks, toxic exposure, and intentional infliction of emotional distress. It's actually quite difficult to know exactly how many torts occur every year in the United States. Millions of car accidents are reported annually, but not every accident involves a tort, and not every tort gets reported or results in a filed lawsuit. Most people who are tortiously harmed never file a legal claim at all, and even when a lawyer is retained, most tort cases settle, often through negotiation with an insurance company, before a complaint is ever filed in court. The most comprehensive study of the tort system, published by the National Center for State Courts, offers a revealing picture. Of the tort claims that are actually filed with a court, fewer than 3% ever go to trial. Yet even though tort claims make up only around 4-6% of all civil filings, they account for roughly 60% of the civil trial docket, meaning tort cases are far less likely than other civil cases to be dismissed or settled before trial. The overall number of tort filings has declined significantly over recent decades. For a mix of reasons, safer technology and better regulation have reduced certain categories of injury, such as car accidents, even as the number of accidents has risen, and the tort reform movement has pushed through measures like damages caps and heightened pleading requirements that make some cases harder or less profitable to bring. Despite this decline, there's little evidence that it reflects courts weeding out weak claims. Most cases still settle, and for the small number that reach trial, plaintiffs win roughly half the time, a figure that has held remarkably steady for decades, with a slightly higher win rate in bench trials than in jury trials. The numbers on time and money are also worth noting. A tort suit typically takes about a year and a half to resolve if tried before a judge, and about 2 years if tried before a jury, and that doesn't include the time spent investigating before filing, or any subsequent appeal, which happens in roughly 11% of cases. The average tort trial lasts about 4 days, though asbestos cases can run 13 days or more, and malpractice and product liability trials also tend to run long. About 90% of tort trials are jury trials rather than bench trials. As for money, the median jury award in 2005 was around $24,000, only slightly higher than the median bench trial award of about $21,000. Both figures reflecting roughly a 50% decline since 1992. Punitive damages, which go beyond compensating the plaintiff and are meant to punish or deter the defendant, were awarded in fewer than 5% of tort trials overall, though the rate rose considerably as the size of compensatory damages increased. And however damages are ultimately paid, whether through a trial verdict or a settlement, liability insurance covers as much as 85% of all tort payouts, which is a reminder of just how central insurance is to how tort law actually functions in practice. Finally, it's worth understanding a bit about where the tort reform movement came from. Starting in the 1980s, a perceived liability insurance crisis, with sharply rising premiums, especially for doctors and other professionals, led to intense political pressure on state legislatures to change tort law. Whether the real cause was the underlying economics of the insurance industry or the substantive law of negligence itself is disputed, but nearly every state passed some form of reform legislation in response. These changes touched the standard of care, the doctrine of informed consent, the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur, the collateral source rule, statutes of limitations, and caps on damages, among other things. Some states required a certificate of merit before a malpractice suit could proceed. Others required review by an expert panel or mandatory arbitration first. Several state Supreme Courts have since struck down some of these reforms as unconstitutional. For instance, damages caps in medical malpractice cases have been found in some states to violate the right to a jury trial or equal protection guarantees. Section 4. Trial court procedure in tort cases. Because most of the cases you'll read in a torts casebook are appellate opinions, it helps enormously to understand the mechanics of a trial. Since an appellate court is really only reviewing some specific alleged legal error made by the trial court below, not re-deciding the whole case from scratch. So when you read an appellate opinion, the first question to ask yourself is, what exactly is the appellant arguing the trial court did wrong? To answer that, you need a basic map of how a civil trial unfolds. Here is that map, in 10 stages, assuming a jury trial under rules similar to the federal rules of civil procedure. Stage 1, the plaintiff files a complaint, laying out the facts that, if true, would establish every element of the claim being asserted. The defendant typically responds with an answer, admitting or denying those facts, or alternatively, files a motion to dismiss, arguing that even if everything the plaintiff alleges is true, those facts simply don't add up to a valid legal claim. So the case should be thrown out without ever reaching a jury. Stage 2. If the case survives the pleading stage, the parties enter discovery, a period of formal investigation, often lengthy, and often the subject of disputes that the trial judge has to resolve. As discovery unfolds, the parties will often file motions for summary judgment, asking the court to resolve the whole case, or often just particular elements of it, without a trial. A defendant's summary judgment motion only needs to knock out one required element of the plaintiff's claim to win, because the plaintiff bears the burden of proving every element. A plaintiff moving for summary judgment, by contrast, has to establish every element of the claim as a matter of law. The key difference between a motion to dismiss and a motion for summary judgment is that a motion to dismiss looks only at the pleadings, while summary judgment considers the fuller evidentiary record developed in discovery. A court will grant summary judgment when there's no genuine dispute over the material facts, or when the court assumes the disputed facts in favor of the party opposing the motion, and the moving party is nonetheless entitled to win as a matter of law. Because the Seventh Amendment guarantees the right to a jury trial, this is an extremely deferential standard. A judge can only take a case away from the jury if no reasonable jury could possibly decide it any other way. Stage 3. Assuming the case isn't dismissed or settled, it proceeds to jury selection, where attorneys try to identify favorable jurors and begin shaping the jury's view of the case. Stage 4. Once the jury is seated, both sides deliver opening statements, previewing the evidence, and their theory of the case. Stage 5. The plaintiff presents its case in chief, calling witnesses and introducing evidence, while the defense cross-examines and objects as appropriate. The trial judge rules on those objections. And an erroneous ruling here can be grounds for a later appeal if it likely affected the outcome. Stage 6. Before presenting its own case, the defendant may move for a directed verdict, arguing that even without any defense evidence at all, no reasonable jury could find for the plaintiff based on what's already been presented. Stage 7. If that motion is denied, the defense presents its own case, again subject to cross-examination and evidentiary objections, and the plaintiff typically gets an opportunity to offer rebuttal evidence afterward. At the close of all the evidence, either side may again move for a directed verdict, using the same standard. Viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, could reasonable minds differ about the outcome? If not, the judge takes the case away from the jury entirely and decides it as a matter of law. Stage 8. Assuming the case survives all of that, the lawyers deliver closing arguments. Stage 9. The trial judge then instructs the jury on the applicable law, drawing on both parties' proposed instructions and often on standard model instructions used in that jurisdiction. Because faulty jury instructions can taint an otherwise sound verdict, and because instructing the jury is purely a matter for the judge rather than the jury, appellate courts review jury instructions without giving any deference at all to the trial court, what's called de novo review. Stage 10. The jury deliberates and returns a verdict, which the court then formally enters. After the verdict, the losing party may move for what's called judgment notwithstanding the verdict, sometimes abbreviated JNOV, which asks the judge to override the jury's decision, a highly deferential standard, typically requiring a showing that the verdict was the product of passion, prejudice, or corruption, or was wholly unsupported by the evidence. A motion for a new trial requires somewhat less deference, arguing instead that errors during the trial were serious enough to have unfairly prejudiced the jury's decision. Understanding all 10 of these stages matters, because it tells you, as a reader of appellate opinions, exactly what kind of error is being challenged and how much deference the appellate court owes to the decision below. Part 2. Case Summaries and IRAC Narration. The following three cases all appear in Section 2 of Chapter 1, on the historical development of fault-based liability. Each case is presented first as a short narrative summary of what happened, and then again in issue, rule, application, and conclusion form, spoken as continuous narration. Case 1, Brown v. Kendall, Massachusetts, 1850. Summary, two dogs, one belonging to the plaintiff George Brown, and one belonging to the defendant George Kendall, were fighting. Kendall tried to separate them by beating them with a stick. As he backed away from the dogs while raising the stick over his shoulder, he accidentally struck Brown, who was standing behind him, in the eye, causing serious injury. There was no dispute that the blow was unintentional. At trial, the judge instructed the jury that if separating the dogs was something Kendall had a duty to do, he only needed to use ordinary care, but if it was merely something he was permitted but not required to do, then he was liable unless he used extraordinary care. And the judge placed the burden of proving that extraordinary care on Kendall himself. The jury found for Brown, and Kendall appealed. This case matters, historically, because it is widely regarded as the first clear American statement of the modern negligence standard, liability based on fault, rather than liability simply because the defendant's act caused an injury. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue before the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court was this: when a defendant's unintentional act injures a plaintiff during the course of an otherwise lawful activity, what standard governs the defendant's liability? and which party bears the burden of proving that standard was met or violated. The rule the court announced was that a defendant is only liable for an unintentional injury if the plaintiff proves the defendant failed to use ordinary care, meaning the kind of care that a prudent and cautious person would use under the circumstances, calibrated to the danger involved. If the injury was the result of pure accident, with both parties exercising ordinary care, or if the plaintiff also failed to use ordinary care, then the plaintiff cannot recover. Critically, the court held that it is the plaintiff, not the defendant, who bears the burden of proving fault. The trial judge's instruction shifting that burden to the defendant was reversible error. Applying that rule to the facts, the court reasoned that Kendall's act of trying to separate the fighting dogs, one of which was his own, was a lawful and proper act if, while performing that lawful act with due care and proper precautions, Kendall accidentally struck Brown, the resulting injury was the product of pure accident rather than fault, and no liability should follow. The court found nothing in the case requiring a distinction between acts Kendall was legally obligated to perform and acts he was merely permitted to perform. In either case, the standard was the same ordinary care, and in either case, it was Brown's burden to prove that standard had been breached, not Kendall's burden to disprove it. The court's conclusion was that the trial judge's instruction improperly shifted the burden of proof to the defendant, and so the court ordered a new trial to be conducted under the correct rule. The plaintiff must affirmatively prove that the defendant was either acting unlawfully or was at fault. And if the harm was truly unavoidable despite the defendant's exercise of ordinary care, there is no liability at all. Case 2, Cohen v. Petty, District of Columbia, 1933. Summary: the plaintiff was riding as a guest passenger in a car driven by the defendant. While driving at a moderate to somewhat high speed, the defendant suddenly exclaimed that he felt sick, and moments later the car swerved off the road and crashed into an embankment, throwing the plaintiff and her sister from the vehicle. The defendant's uncontradicted testimony, corroborated by his wife who was in the front seat, was that he had suddenly and unexpectedly fainted, without any prior history of fainting spells, and without any reason to anticipate the episode. The trial judge directed a verdict for the defendant, taking the case away from the jury, and the plaintiff appealed that decision. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue on appeal was whether the trial court was justified in directing a verdict for the defendant. In other words, whether the plaintiff had presented enough evidence of negligence to let a reasonable jury find the defendant liable, given his defense of a sudden and unforeseeable fainting spell. The rule the court applied was well established. A driver who is suddenly stricken by an illness that he had no reason to anticipate, and which renders him unable to control the vehicle, is not chargeable with negligence for the resulting accident. Sudden, unforeseeable incapacitation simply removes the element of fault that negligence law requires. Applying that rule, the court found that all of the evidence, including the plaintiff's own testimony about hearing the defendant say he felt sick immediately before the crash, pointed the same direction. There was nothing to suggest the defendant knew or should have known he was susceptible to fainting. He testified he had never fainted before and believed himself to be in good health that day. Because the plaintiff offered no evidence of negligence prior to the loss of control, and because the defendant's evidence of a sudden, unanticipated fainting spell was positive and completely uncontradicted, there was simply no factual basis on which a reasonable jury could find the defendant at fault. The court's conclusion was to affirm the directed verdict for the defendant, because sudden, unforeseeable incapacity negates fault, and because the plaintiff could point to no evidence undermining the defendant's account, the case was correctly taken away from the jury rather than submitted to it. Case 3, Spano v. Perini Corp. Summary: the defendants were constructing a tunnel for the city of New York, and in the course of that work, detonated a substantial blast of dynamite, 194 sticks, only about 125 feet from the plaintiff's garage. The blast wrecked the garage and also allegedly damaged a car that had been left there for repairs, owned by a second plaintiff. Both plaintiffs sued, but at trial, they made a deliberate strategic choice. Rather than trying to prove the defendants had been negligent in how they carried out the blasting, they relied entirely on the theory that blasting operations should trigger absolute or strict liability, meaning liability without any need to prove negligence at all. This required the New York Court of Appeals to revisit its own older precedent, a case called Booth, which had held that a blaster was only strictly liable if the blast caused a direct physical invasion of the plaintiff's property, such as rocks landing on it. If the damage instead came from concussion or vibration alone, the older rule required proof of negligence. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue before the court was whether a property owner who suffers damage from nearby blasting must prove that the blaster was negligent, or whether the blaster can instead be held strictly liable for any resulting damage regardless of the degree of care used, and, specifically, whether that answer should depend on whether the damage came from a direct physical invasion of debris or merely from vibration and concussion. The rule the court adopted was that a party who engages in blasting is absolutely liable for any damage the blasting causes to neighboring property, without any need to show negligence, and without regard to whether the damage came from flying debris or from concussion alone. In doing so, the court expressly overruled its own earlier decision in Booth, which had drawn that trespass versus vibration distinction, and aligned New York with what the court described as the overwhelming majority rule among American jurisdictions. In applying, and really in justifying that rule, the court reasoned that the distinction the old Booth case had relied on made no practical sense, whether debris physically lands on someone's property or the same explosion instead shakes their house to pieces through vibration, is a difference in the mechanism of harm, not in the blaster's underlying culpability, or in the danger posed by the activity. The court also pointed out that its own older cases predating Booth, involving an exploding gunpowder magazine and a blasting operation that threw earth and stones onto a plaintiff's property, had already recognized that any explosion in a built-up area is inherently likely to cause damage, regardless of the specific mechanism. The court further rejected Booth's underlying policy rationale that shielding blasters from strict liability was necessary to promote the development and improvement of property, reasoning that this framing misstated what was really at stake. The plaintiff wasn't trying to stop the defendants from blasting or from improving their property at all. He was simply asking to be compensated for the damage the blasting caused to his own property. The real question, the court concluded, was not whether blasting should be allowed, but who should bear the cost when it damages a neighbor's property. The party who chose to engage in the inherently dangerous activity, or the innocent neighbor who did nothing to cause the harm? The court's conclusion was that the plaintiffs did not need to prove negligence at all. The mere fact that the blasting caused the damage, if proven, would be enough to establish liability, because the lower appellate court had affirmed the trial court's ruling for the defendants solely on the ground that no negligence had been shown, without ever considering whether the blasting had actually caused the plaintiff's damage. The Court of Appeals remanded the case back down so that the causation question could finally be addressed under the newly clarified strict liability standard. End of Chapter 1 narration script. This concludes the narration script for Chapter 1. The next chapter in the casebook, Chapter 2, covers intentional interference with person or property, beginning with the doctrine of intent.